I just had a little more to say this morning about this subject that I was assigned. I can remember when I was working at a machine shop many years ago, about 40 years ago. This machine shop was like about any other machine shop that I've ever known of, and that is that the talk in the shop was pretty much perverse from 7 o'clock in the morning till 5:30 in the afternoon. All the time we were there, there was a lot of perverse discussion going on, primarily about sexual type issues. I think that's just the nature of man. So this was going on around, and I remember on one occasion conversing about sexual issues with one of the men in that shop. I told him I wanted to be a virgin when I got married, and he said, well, I sure wouldn't buy a pair of shoes unless I'd tried them on. That is the common view in the world, I think, that we need to have sex before we get married to see if it's going to be what we want. The truth of the matter is, from a biblical point of view, almost always the physical equipment works just fine. That isn't the issue. Sex outside of marriage is an experience that we do not need prior to marriage. And I told you this morning as we were ending that sex outside of marriage is going to have an adverse effect on marriage, even if you marry the same person. Thousands of couples have difficulties in marriage because of the previous experiences that they have had. It's just a lie of the devil to say that you should arrive at your wedding night experience. As a matter of fact, that puts a weight on you that you could well do without, and marriages collapse every day under that weight. There are a number of adverse effects from having had sex before marriage. One is sometimes one or the other of the marriage partners will feel dirty and feel used. I just can't feel right about it. We got off on the wrong foot, and it used to be wrong. Now it's right, but I don't feel right about it. It's not enjoyable because it is still in their mind associated with wrongness. Or there'll be a fear. I have a fear that something's going to happen to this baby because of what I used to do. Or a fear later on, after that baby gets to be a teenager. Is my teenager going to do what I did? And what can I say to them about this? Or there'll be a lack of trust. He told you when you were dating, well, I don't know about other guys, but I'm just too much of a man to restrain myself. And so he broke the rules with you. And now that you're married, you wonder if he can control himself when he's out of town on business trips. The fact of the matter is that a fornicator before marriage can more easily become an adulterer during marriage because he has learned to cross the line of his conscience. Sometimes people will actually have flashbacks, memories of being with other people that cannot be forgotten. And sometimes people make comparisons. I wonder if I'm as good as she was. I wonder if I'm as good as he was. If two virgins get married, they don't have that kind of interference. They can enjoy their ignorance about other people and just ignore everybody except themselves in the relationship. Sometimes, because of sex before marriage, there's a lack of relaxation within the marriage. I don't think you can condition your responses for years in tense times of wondering if somebody's going to catch you and then all of a sudden just relax with your husband or wife. It's easy for couples to develop a bad is exciting syndrome, develop an excitement in doing wrong. Oh, don't. We shouldn't, but then we do. And we're perverting our responses. We now look for something else that's wrong to excite us because we have this bad is exciting syndrome. Now that we're married, everything is okay and it becomes boring, and so we need to go on to some other level. This is one of the implications of perversion in our time. Perversion is often used because everything else seems passé. But sex is a sharing of our entire beings. The more partners and the more experiences we have outside of the marriage container, the more pieces of ourselves we're giving away and the less fulfillment we're likely to end up with. There's a wounding there, and it brings a shallowness to our emotions. We have trouble finding a true depth of fulfillment, and that can bring disinterest, it can bring a lack of satisfaction, and it can bring frustration. We don't draw as much from the well as we had hoped or as God had intended. But God's intention was depth and satisfaction and fulfillment. He limits our behavior before marriage not to take away the fulfillment, but to channel this beautiful river the same way the banks of a river channel the river. It's stupid to knock down the banks of a river just because you feel like the river isn't free enough. Well, that river looks too restricted by its banks, so we'll take the banks away and it becomes a flood or a marsh that isn't appealing at all. And I don't think even the river enjoys being a flood or a marsh. The river likes to be where it's supposed to be. If the river says, I'm going to flow where I want to, I'm going to flow where I feel like flowing, and there's no banks there, then it just becomes a stinking, dirty picture. So the Lord tells us to say no to destruction and say yes to God and God's logical, loving limits. And once we understand why God said what He said, maybe it won't be as hard to control ourselves when we understand why it is that we're supposed to control ourselves. This is an area that all of us, I think without exception, need to guard ourselves in, because the world is pulling us in the opposite direction all the time. Old or young, that's true. But especially I feel for our young people on this issue. We need to guard ourselves, because when we go beyond God's limits in this area, you're not just sinning against your own body, although you are. You're not just sinning against the other person, although you are. You're not just sinning against your spouse, if you have one. But our attitude should be the same as the attitude of Joseph was in Egypt. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? He understood, though he lived in a patriarchal time with less light than we have, he understood that to sleep with Potiphar's wife would have been to sin against God. Now, if you have been a fornicator in your life, that doesn't mean that your life is over, and it doesn't mean it's completely ruined. But it is true that once sin enters in, there's not always an ideal solution to the problem. We have to continue to remember that Jesus is a Redeemer, that He will forgive and cleanse and heal and restore, and that God can work mightily in your life. If you come to Him and admit that He really knew what He was talking about all the time and that you were wrong to second guess Him, if you repent and by faith let Him reverse that damage and set your foot on a road with guardrails, you can still have a good life. But the repentance means that you're turning and going a different direction and that you realize that you went in the wrong direction. So much better just to go in the right direction from the beginning. Yes, He can make all things new, but why set yourself in a place where you have so much to overcome? Take God at His word. Believe that He knows what's best for you. Two, become one flesh in marriage. There's the leaving and the cleaving and the unity. And this sexual relationship within marriage is a beautiful thing. It has the dimensions of physicality, but soulishness and spirituality as well. And if any one of those is missing, you're going to be experiencing a watered down and diluted relationship. I believe that a good sex life is more the result of a good relationship than the cause of it. In other words, I don't think it so much causes a good relationship as that a good relationship springs from a good relationship. There's so much emphasis on the physical in our time, from biological evolution that tells us how we got here in physical terms to sexual training and all this type of thing that tells you how to get it right physically. People are striving through the physical to produce a good relationship and looking for the perfect sexual experience, when really we need the depth of relationship on every level. And then a good physical relationship should come from that. We got to put the physical in the right perspective in every area of life, including the sexual relationship. I think it is true to say that the most important sexual organ you have is your brain. And what is programmed into your mind determines a great deal about your relationship. Because every time you engage in sexuality, or even in heavy petting, it involves all that you are as a person. And it's supposed to develop over a long period of time to grow, mature, progress. It takes a man and a woman an entire lifetime to enjoy one another fully in this area. It doesn't happen overnight. In fact, it's true to say in some cases that young married couples do not often feel like it's everything they hoped it would be right at the first. But they learn to develop and grow into this relationship. There are many things that our young people face in our time, and I'd like to address just a few of those with regard to this issue of premarital sex, because there's, I think, more pressure on our young people today than there ever has been to engage in premarital sex. It's almost, they're almost looked at as being oddities if they choose not to do this. It's like people aren't even allowed in popular thinking to decide yes or no. It's that you're very odd if you decide no. And a lot of people will try to manipulate you into engaging in this. Sometimes there's an attitude on the part of a young man or a woman that will say, I'll love you if you'll do something. I'll love you if you'll marry me. I'll love you if you'll go to bed with me. Many people know no other type of love than this sort of conditional love. This is done to young people growing up all the time by parents and others. I'm going to love you if you get good grades. I'll love you if you behave in a certain way. But that's a conditional type of love. You ought not to settle for a conditional relationship with somebody that you're getting romantically involved with. The opposite of that would be the love because of. I love you because you're pretty. I love you because you give me a sense of security. I love you because you're rich. This type of thing. Now, that can't be the basis of your relationship, or if it is, it's very shallow. If any condition is the basis of your relationship, then you're going to be in trouble. What happens when somebody else comes along who is richer or prettier or has more of whatever the quality is that you're being loved for? Then you're in deep insecurity over that. And there's a lot of competition that develops. There's a lot of fear. What happens when the quality that you're loved for changes? You're no longer rich. You're no longer pretty. There's a car accident and you've been maimed. Are you still going to be loved the way that you should be loved, the way that you want to be loved? And so what we need is a relationship that is an unconditional love that loves to bestow itself to the good of the beloved object. This is Christian love, and we love within a Christian relationship. I do not believe that we should marry somebody who is not a Christian. If we ourselves are a Christian, I don't believe that we should marry somebody who is not a Christian. Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. If you're a Christian and you want to marry somebody who is not a Christian, don't ask me to marry you, because I can not in good conscience do that. True Christian love, which is what we want to have for one another when we're married, always thinks of the other person first. It's thinking not of getting, but it's thinking of giving. And it accepts, even if the faults of the other person never change, it accepts the other person and loves them anyway. And love can wait. If a boy or a girl tells you that they love you, but then they say, I just can't wait, then there's something wrong with that equation somewhere, because true love can wait to give, but lust can't wait to get. And that's the difference that sometimes it's hard to delineate between when we're young. Creative Christian love causes creative changes in the one that's loved very often, changes for the better. So we're talking about giving versus a self-centeredness. If you believe that marriage is a 50-50 proposition, then you ought not to get married, because you need to be willing to give 100%. And if your spouse is willing to give 100%, you ought to be able to get along reasonably well. Don't get married if you think it's just a 50-50 thing. I'll address one other thing, because there is a difference between the genders, and there has been some change in thinking over the past several decades with regard to this. It used to be thought by many people that women are less sexually responsive than men are. I've never believed that, and I don't believe it now. I just think women tend to be stimulated sexually by things other than what stimulate men sometimes. So there is a difference between the genders, but it seems anti-biblical to think that women are less sexually responsive than men. I don't think the Bible bears that out. Now, in the Kinsey report, they recommended that women have various sexual experiences before marriage, because supposedly the man who loves you as he loves himself, supposedly that man is not going to have much patience with you if you haven't had experiences before marriage. This is just the opposite of what the Bible teaches. The world and the devil and the Bible and the Lord are just diametrically opposed on this issue. I hope that if you get married at all, you find somebody who loves you and you can make these adjustments together. And if you make these adjustments together within the commitment of a God-ordained marriage, then you have a great advantage. But what so often happens in high school, or even before that these days, is the boy will say to the girl, well, if you love me, you'll let me. And she has public opinion and the media and virtually everything going against her. And so even if she knows better, she can tend to cave into that. When really the right answer is, hey, if you loved me, you wouldn't persist. Stand up for yourself on this. If he says, I can't help myself, well, he just needs to learn some self-discipline. If he says, everybody's doing it, or if she says, everybody's doing it, the answer to that is, oh, no, they aren't. There are plenty of young people around who are maintaining their virginity. And what a reason to do something anyway, just because everybody's doing it. Why let the world mold you? Look at the mess the world's in. They don't have the answers for you. God has the answers for you. If somebody says, well, just this once, I love you, so let's just do it this once. Are you going to be satisfied with once? If you like it, you're not. And if you don't like it, then you've created an impediment for your future life. I've had girls especially ask me, how do I explain to my boyfriend why I want to wait? He doesn't understand why I want to wait, and it seems very difficult for him, and I feel like I'm just frustrating him just by existing, just by being with him. I'm frustrating him sexually. How do I explain to my boyfriend why I want to wait? The first thing I have to say about that is, if your word no is not enough for him, then that tells you a whole lot about him and the relationship that you're in. If he persists through your word no, he doesn't love you. He may not even know what love is. Anybody who will push you in this area now will push you in other areas later on. And, you know, if you love me, you'll let me. And later on, it'll be, if you love me, you'll get an abortion because of what our relationship has created. And we're going to go to college. We don't have time for this right now. We don't have the money for it. So if you love me, you'll get an abortion. It never stops once you cave into these things. They will push you in another area if you allow them to push you in this. Why? Because that's the kind of person they are. I wouldn't want somebody with that attitude to be the co-parent of my children. Why do you have to explain why you want to wait? You said no, that ought to be enough. There's nothing incumbent upon you that would make you have to explain it at all. It's your body, it's your life, it's your decision. Why can't he respect you for who you are and for what you say? Why should you wait? Well, God said to wait, and we explored this morning some of the reasons perhaps why God said to wait, but even if he didn't have any reasons, and even if we couldn't think up any reasons as to why to wait, it still would be true that the Bible would say that God says to wait. If we love God and we believe that he is who we say he is, then his word on this ought to be enough. He thought it all up. It was 100% his idea. He knows what works best. And he says, as Britt just read for us in 1 Corinthians 6:18, flee fornication. Fornication is illicit sexual intercourse. Flee fornication. Every time God gives us a negative commandment, there are positive principles behind it. That's true of every negative commandment God ever gave. Every time he said, thou shalt not, there were positive reasons for the negativity. God is not a negative God. He's not by nature a restrictor. He's by nature a fulfiller. He's trying to fulfill us, and sometimes he has to be negative to do that. Every negative command God ever gave, Old Testament or New, was either to protect people from something bad or to provide them with something good. He wants you to have the best relationship you can with your husband or wife, either present or future. He wants you to have the best relationship that you can. There are many times in marriage that you cannot have sex. There are times of illness. There are times of separation. There are times of pregnancy in the later stages when it's just not convenient in some cases. If you have already learned when you were single to control yourself sexually, then you can control yourself later. And this adds trust to the relationship. She knows that he can control himself. He knows that she can control herself because they have seen this demonstrated in one another. Because my wife knows that I controlled myself before, she knows that I can control myself afterward. And if you can control yourself in this area, probably you can control yourself in the other major areas of life. That's what James said about the tongue. If anybody has that handled pretty well, then you ought to be able to control you're a mature person if you can handle your tongue. I think the same would be true with your sexuality, or something similar. A similar point could be made there. If we can control ourselves in this area, that means that we are a disciplined person. And disciplined people are like that river within the banks. It's a beautiful thing to watch a disciplined person function. It can be a very ugly thing to watch an undisciplined life unravel. How can you control this? Constantly remind yourself that in the long run, it's harder not to obey God. The way of the transgressor is hard. That's what the Old Testament said. And we see this proven to be true again and again. The people who are blatantly sexually disobedient to God are not the happy people around us in the world. In many cases, they're succumbing to suicide, they're succumbing to deep depression, and they're not finding the fulfillment that they themselves are actually seeking. I have a theory that human beings are all seeking for the same thing. They're seeking for that wholeness that God designed us to have. It's just that if we do this outside God's parameter, we're not going to find it. And we scratch our heads in confusion wondering why we're not finding it. Because we got the money, we got the freedom, but why am I not finding the satisfaction? It's no surprise that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards can't get no satisfaction. They're not approaching this from a godly point of view, and that's the only way to approach it for a lasting satisfaction. In the long run, it's harder not to obey God. But in America in particular, we're programmed for immediate satisfaction. People go to the hospital no matter what's wrong with them and just expect the doctors to fix it so they can walk out and live a healthy life again. It doesn't always work out that way. But that's the expectation in America. Anyone who always goes for immediate satisfaction is never going or seldom going to experience the best in life. Like Longfellow's poem said, learn to labor and to wait. And there is something about waiting that does a great deal for us. There's a whole lot in the Bible about waiting on the Lord. But waiting is difficult. The waiting room can be a difficult place to be. You don't know when the doctor is going to come out and tell you how the surgery went, so you're just waiting. It's like being in limbo. And especially in America, we don't like to wait. We like everything quick and instant. But sex the way God meant it becomes what it should be only through control and through patience. We're all creatures of habit, they say, and I think that's true. And if we get in the wrong habit on this issue, it's a difficult habit to break and to respond in God's way. We talked about wrenches and hammers and cameras being developed from various parts of the body. I think actually it's true that the computer itself was developed from the body. Gerhard Dirks and others worked on this and actually used some of the things the body, in particular the brain, does to develop the computer. Computers are programmed, and the body is programmed by what it sees and what it hears and what it does. And when we engage in sexuality, we are programming ourselves and the person that we're involved with. We're programming one another. I have known people who were so programmed sexually by other experiences that they had had that when they came to marriage, they found it difficult to be programmed by their husband or wife. They'd already been programmed by other people. It's best if we start as a blank slate and be programmed together. We program one another over time, and we don't have a lot of garbage in there that we need to overcome. I have known young men who had flashbacks that were just as dramatic, just as vivid, as if they had been from LSD trips, but they weren't. They were from previous sexual experiences. And these would occur during the sexual relationship with the woman who's now their wife, but they're flashing back to these other sexual experiences, and it became a real problem for them. Because your brain never forgets these things. It's all right there in the frontal lobe. This is one of the indictments against pornography as well. Our brain does not forget. The things that we see and hear are recorded and stored away, and we're made shallower, we're made number, and it's harder for us to even feel our feelings eventually if we continue on that kind of a path. Oh, there's so much to say on this area, but I wanted to leave a little time for your comments, if you have them. I don't know whether you'll have them or not. I know this is an area that we're maybe not as forthcoming about as some other areas, and that might be as it should be. It's a very private and personal area. There are things in life that we ought always to be able to blush about, and I hope we never lose the ability to blush about some of the aspects of this subject. I'm talking about it, number one, because, as I said, I was asked to by the eldership, and also because I feel like in this 21st century now, since we're getting bombarded with this from every other direction. You know, back in the Victorian age, they talked a lot about death and were very open about that and had a rather morbid, introspective view of death, and they wouldn't talk about sex. And now it's almost shifted over. People are very uncomfortable about death and don't like to think about it too much, get very upset if it's brought up too much. But there's a lot of talk about sex. So we've switched over in the past 100 years or so in our thinking there. And because of that, there's all this talk about it from the world. The world is bombarding us. I feel like in the church, we need to see this from God's point of view, biblically speaking. The Bible addresses every kind of sex that there is, both legitimate and deviant sex, and it affirms the one and condemns the other, and we ought to be able to speak about this. But I will say this, if I have offended anyone by being as explicit as I have, that rests with me and not the eldership that assigned this subject, and I'm willing to take the blame for that. Anybody have anything that you wanted to ask or say on anything we've talked about today? Randy, go ahead. Yes, indeed there is, and this is a whole big subject that I think we face new issues. I shouldn't say new issues. We face a lot more emphasis on the area of sex gone awry in our time because of internet pornography, etc. It used to be, I think everything that exists now used to exist, but it was just in a much smaller proportion of the population and much more hidden at one time. I can remember when I was in the sixth grade at Blue Ridge Grade School over in Raytown, a boy brought a playing card one day that had a picture on it that was unlike anything I had ever seen before, and it was pornography. And I saw that, and I knew that it must have come from a deck of playing cards. There would have been 52 in that deck, and probably each one may have had a different picture on it. This all existed back then, but it was just not as easily accessible, and you didn't tend to see it, and if you didn't see it, then you weren't thinking about it so much. We used to walk along as boys sometimes. Maybe we'd come to a place where people had dumped some trash and there might be some pornography in there, so you just kind of stumbled upon it and you could see that. But it was not in your house at your fingertips like it is now. So as a result of this, in the sexual area, we're developing a large population of sexual addicts, people who are addicted to various kinds of sexual responses. In the same way that we have people addicted to alcohol, addicted to gambling, addicted to virtually any kind of thing, we have a great deal of people who are sexual addicts. Some of them are in the church. It's sort of hidden, and because it thankfully is still a taboo subject to some extent. But there's a lot there. Now, what do you do if you're involved in that? People find themselves on the even hurting, damaging themselves physically because they're so involved in this type of thing, hurting themselves in ways other than physically, and hurting other people, living a life that's out of control. It's tricky because, if you're addicted to alcohol, you can stay out of bars, and that will solve it. If you just stay away from alcohol, that should pretty much solve that issue, if you could just stay away from alcohol. But if you're addicted to food, for example, it's not that easy because the food addict cannot stop eating entirely. And so there's still going to be around food, and it's tricky. How do you deal with a food addiction if you have it and yet still nourish your body? And sexuality is like that for a married person, at least. They're still going to be sexual eventually if they're married, we hope. But how do they deal with this and get it in the right direction? There's a lot of literature on this, and I think it would explore it in more depth than I can. But the main point here is that there is hope. There's a way to fix this. Even people in the world's totally secular sources point to these ways to fix it, because eventually you get to the place where it's just out of control. And it's obvious to everyone who knows about it that it needs to be fixed. If somebody is an alcoholic, they may just keep on with that until things get so bad that they hit bottom, as we say, and then they want to fix it because it just got so bad. As long as it seemed controllable, they didn't try to fix it. And that's usually the way this goes. And as long as it seems controllable, people don't do too much about it. It's only when they are exposed or when there's some catastrophe, they find that they just have no control over themselves at all, and they're living in a fantasy world that they themselves are in, and it's not the real world at all. Then they'll try to do something about it. And I would recommend books like Don't Call It Love by Patrick Carnes, C-A-R-N-E-S. If you have an addiction here or something that you're finding very difficult to control, what they recommend is a period of celibacy to begin with. And this would even be true for married people. A period of celibacy to begin and then go from there. They have a 12-step program just like Alcoholics Anonymous does, or just like any of these other groups have. And it's written entirely from a secular point of view, which to me makes it interesting and maybe even more helpful, because they're not saying, well, here's what God wants. That's what the Bible says. But they're saying, even from a worldly, secular point of view, where we think you ought to be able to live any way you want to, it doesn't work to abuse your sexuality. You need to keep it within certain confines and do it for certain reasons, because these secular writers will say, it's a spiritual experience. They're saying the same thing the Lord said, and they're saying it because there's really no other way to look at it. It's just not a totally physical experience. There are spiritual aspects to it, and if you ignore that, then you're going to come up with a very unsatisfactory result. Now, if you're not that far along, if you wouldn't call yourself a sexual addict, but yet you have become involved in this and used to it, the way of the transgressor is hard, and if you want to get back into godly living, it's going to be very difficult, or it can be very difficult. But it is doable. If you, for instance, are a young person and you have no right to be sexual, but you have engaged in sexual intercourse with someone, the thing for you to do is to stop that immediately until you are married. And the more time that you go through celibacy, the better it will be for you. You'll never be able to recapture your virginity again, but you can achieve something that will approach that if you begin from where you are right now and live life in a godly way. God is all about new beginnings. That's the good news of the gospel, that change is possible at any time, and that we start where we are. Where else can you start? We start where we are, and we embrace the Lord and live as He would have us to live. And if we slip, that doesn't mean we have to go into a binge. Don't be a perfectionist about it. A lot of times people will say, well, I slipped, and so I'll just drink the whole bottle. Or I slipped, and so I'll just stay here and gamble for 3 days until my ankles swell up and they can't even fit into my shoes anymore. Or I slipped, so I'll just go to an orgy. No. If you slip, then embrace the grace of God. Tell Him how sorry you are that you did that, and He will receive you. If you confess your sins, He is faithful and just to forgive you your sins and to cleanse you from all unrighteousness. That's our bar of soap from 1 John. If you wonder whether you're saved, read 1 John. It seems to have been written explicitly to tell the Lord's people that they are saved. If our heart condemns us, He is greater than our hearts. If God says you're saved, who are you to say you're not? But you've got to be in the right attitude. You need to be living for Him. If you don't believe right now that you're saved, do what it takes in the next few seconds so that you can believe that you're saved. And if you can't believe that you're saved by praying to the Lord in sincerity, then you may have a skewed view of what the Bible is saying to you. I think in the Churches of Christ traditionally, we may have skewed people's views on this subject. We were reacting against other points of view that said, once saved, always saved. And so we'd say, well, that's totally wrong. So we went 180 degrees the other way. But we can know that we're saved. John makes that quite clear. He that hath the Son hath life. So the gospel is about hope. It's good news, not bad news. And you can start from where you are, wherever that is, and live a godly life and have fulfillment in your life. I wouldn't want any, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I wouldn't want anybody, but especially a young person, to feel like, well, I've given away my virginity, so I'm just ruined goods now. I'm just damaged goods, and therefore there's no reason for me to try to be a godly person anymore. That's not true at all. You have to start from where you are and live a godly life. And if you do slip, then start from that point and live a godly life. Keep coming back to the Lord. That's what King David did, and he was a man after God's own heart. You want to follow up on that, Randy? Or should we say any more about that? Kyle.
Abstain from it, but also give yourself righteous choice to do. Right. Maybe when you're feeling overcome with temptation, maybe open the neighbor leaves flower bed or something.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned something in your hypothetical example there, something physical, because I do think that physicality can help us with this. If you're experiencing sexual temptation for which there you have no legitimate outlet, then go out and run or walk or do some hard physical work. That does wonders for us. It releases chemicals in our bodies that help us to be able to relax and rest. Many people who become addicted to pornography, for example, feel that they cannot rest unless they have gone through the ritual of engaging in that. And for those people, we often suggest physical activity. Go out and run a couple miles. And this puts your body in a condition where it's more prepared to relax. God knew what he was doing when he built us. We talked this morning about being fearfully and wonderfully made. Yes, doing something good for somebody, doing something good for yourself. Be good to yourself. Eat right, rest right, and relate right. Life is really about relationships, and we can develop non-sexual relationships with a variety of people. And when we are tempted, maybe just call up one of those people and say, I'm being tempted again. A lot of the power of these addictions is in the secrecy. We don't tell each other because we're embarrassed about what we're addicted to. And that's normal. That's understandable. Not all bad. But sometimes it's necessary to find at least a few people, or at least one person maybe, that we can talk to about this, and they can monitor our progress. And then if we're feeling overwhelmed with temptation, rather than just go and act out on that temptation, we call that person, and we have their permission to even call them in the middle of the night. We call that person and just say, I'm having a rough time right now. This is the basis of groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is the reason the Lord established the church. This is the church at its best when we can connect with each other in this way. What we make out of the church sometimes is not, it doesn't fulfill everything that God had in mind for us. But I think in a group like this, you're getting a lot of that down pretty well, that it's about the relationships, the connectedness between the people, and how we can help each other with no recrimination, but just with encouragement and goodwill. I appreciate that example very much. Other questions, comments? Okay, well, we must be getting close to, yeah, we've been at this an hour now, so. Yes, who was that? Oh, Felicia.
I think that you can definitely see in society the effects of sexual morality. You know, there's kids that have different dads,
right,
or they don't know.
Right.
Who that is.
Right.
And then it just kind of repeats the cycle.
It does. And what the gospel is about is breaking those negative cycles. Breaking that negative cycle of sin in all of its implications and ramifications. I don't know what will become of the present generation that you're teaching in school, But I know what needs to happen. They need to break this downward spiral, that cycle, and come back out of it and do it God's way. In some cases, I've seen some of these kids that are highly motivated to do it God's way because they've seen that in their parents' generation it didn't work. I was telling somebody the other day that I'm ashamed of my generation with regard to the divorce issue. We dropped the ball there. And I hope that your generation does better than we did, because it's not good. And as teachers that are in school with kids every day, it's just heartaching to see that there are almost no intact nuclear families that are with the father and the mother that started out. And it's very sad. I fear for the future of our country, because it's not going to be any stronger than our families are. But God's got all the answers to this, just as He always had. And any generation can take the Bible and live it, whether they've seen it exemplified in their parents' generation or not. That's excellent, Felicia. Thank you. Yeah, Jim.
I'm arguing in high school.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, and this is just an arbitrary number, but if you've been out of high school more than 10 years, you might very well be appalled at the things that go on in the average public high school in our time. And there seems to be very little that anybody can do about it. A few people who want to do anything about it, but very little that anybody can do about it. The stories that I hear on a regular basis from the teachers and the nurses, it really is appalling, and it gets worse. We taught these kids for a couple of generations now that they're just animals, and now they're really starting to act like it. They believed it. Okay, anybody else? Well, I really appreciate your participation in it. I apologize for any discomfort that was avoidable for you, and that if I could have found a way to avoid it, I would have. But I don't know how to. It's like C.S. Lewis said one time. I remember he said that he was assigned to give a talk on eros, you know, these various words define or words translated as love from the Greek language, and they had him make one talk on agape and another on philia and another on storge, and then the final talk was on eros, but they wanted him to do it without talking about sex. And he was at loose ends to know how to talk about eros without talking about sex. Sometimes we want these things to be covered, but we don't really want them to be talked about, maybe. I'm not saying that's true here at all, but it can be uncomfortable. I apologize if I have made you uncomfortable and if I shouldn't have. I'll close with one final thought. When we're young and we're dating, and that's, I guess, our real concern for this lesson is our young people, because you're so precious to us, and we don't want you to make the mistakes that a lot of us did. You have one shot at being young and selecting a mate, and I sure wouldn't want to be back where you are. It was difficult enough the first time, and I'm glad with the result that I got, but I wouldn't want to have to go through all that again. There is a law of diminishing returns that sets in with regard to our sexuality while we're dating. If you put your arm around a girl and you hold hands with a girl or you kiss a girl, you want to go further and further. God has made male-female relationships so that when we start connecting, that relationship is moving in a certain direction where there is a culmination, there is a climax, but that's not supposed to come till marriage. The earlier we start with the kissing and the so forth, the sooner our body is telling us that it wants to get to that climax. So if we can make our dating relationships about relationships, conversation, for example, have good conversations with people, and keep the physical part to a minimum, I think we're ahead there. In life, you take what you want and pay for it. And there is a very heavy price to be paid in the sexual area if we take something that we ought not to take. When I was dating, I wanted to treat girls on a date the same way I wanted somebody to be treating the girl that I was eventually going to marry, whoever she was and wherever she was. I wanted to be able to look my daughter in the eye when she was of dating age and say that I hope that the men that you date will treat you the same way that I treated your mother before we were married. And if you want to be able to say that to your children, then you need to live in such a way now that you can honestly say it to your children. So there's a lot to think about. And when we're young, it's hard to think 20 years down the road. But that'll be here before you know it. Please, let's do it God's way. And you have a lot of brothers and sisters here to talk with and help out who have had some amazing experiences that you may not realize. Try to be close to your brothers and sisters, and they can be a big asset to you. We're going to conclude by extending the Lord's invitation. Tim has announced an invitation number, and if anybody is subject to the invitation this afternoon, please let us know if we can assist you in any way as we stand together and sing.